Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So this morning I'd like to talk about moving beyond the limited self, moving beyond the fictional self. Hi. And I'd like to use two metaphors from the traditional literature. One is a metaphor about a shell, and the other is a metaphor about veils. Okay? So the first one. It's a basic tenet of Buddhism that there's a fictional self that dominates our lives. That's mostly made up of reviewing, regretting, rehearsing, reviewing, regretting, rehearsing, reviewing, regretting, rehearsing. Sound familiar to anybody? Anybody ever experienced that? My cat doesn't experience that. I'll tell you that. That's the human condition that Buddha identified. He said, geez, what's the deal here? He didn't exactly say that, probably. What is the deal here? So bringing the components into view that make up the fictional self is a key part of Zen practice, of all Buddhist practice. So case 16 from the Blue Cliff Records. A monk asked Kyosei, his teacher, I want to peck from the inside. Would you please tap from the outside? Kyosei said, are you committed to becoming alive or not? The monk said, if I do not become alive, I would become a laughingstock. Kyosei said, you too are a fellow in the weeds. So tapping from the outside, pecking from the inside, that's a Zen term, a Buddhist term for breaking through the shell. And as the teacher, supposedly I'm outside. And you guys are stuck inside. And what I try to do is give you support in staying with it by tapping in the right places as you're pecking in the right places so that we can crack the shell open together. That's my job and my pleasure. And as it was my teacher's. So the shell is a fabrication. It's a limited and confined reality that gives us security. It does. But it turns into, and it protects us from all kinds of yucky things out there. But it's also a prison. It imprisons us. And so in traditional Buddhist thought, the self is made up of the aggregates, the skandhas, form, sensation, perception, impulse, and thought. They bunch together to create this fictional self, this elusive self. And especially thought ties them all together. Vijnana, the fifth one, ties them all together. It takes over the whole scene and ties them all together, the fifth one. And of course, there's a need for that, cultural need for that for survival, need for that for many different things. But it doesn't have to become this obsession. And that's what Zen is about, is seeing that it doesn't have to become this obsession. And so as the five bundle together to create this fictional self, so is each of the components of the five a bundle. So they're each bundles, bundles within bundles. Or we could say they're whirling piles of sand. Our sensations are whirling piles of sand. Our perceptions are whirling piles of sand. Our impulses and our thinking. So whirling piles of sand coming together separately to create this so-called Tim. This so-called Tim. This so-called whomever. Chris, Nancy, Wanda, Cynthia. everybody. So it's like a constellation in the sky, right? We have the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, Orion. Those are the only three I remember at the moment. It's been about 45 years since I took an astronomy class. I knew a whole bunch then. Those are the constellations. The Big Dipper is made up of individual stars. We call it the Big Dipper. But we know that's just a fabrication, don't we? We know that. But what happens to you when someone tells you, oh, Erica is just a fabrication? It's your security. It's what you cling to. It's what makes you feel real and solid in a world that's unpredictable, with whirling piles of sand always changing. So in the Big Dipper, there's the brightest stars Alcor and Mizar. Those are the two brightest stars. And we don't even know about them. We only look at the sky and see the Big Dipper, unless we're astronomers. Then we learn about them. And we learn about how brilliant each of them is in and of itself, and how Alcor is not a star. It's a constellation of stars. Just like perception is not perception. It's a constellation of perception. And how Mizar is not a star. It's a constellation of stars. Just like impulse is not impulse. It's a constellation. Etc., etc. Same thing. Constellation being named with lines drawn in between the points of light to shape it into a formation. We are light. We are beings of light. We are naturally enlightened, but we've drawn these lines for cultural purposes, for important cultural purposes, right? But they're just lines we've drawn. So, when I talk about the aggregates, the five aggregates, I like to give examples. So my example from day before yesterday is an example of my new cat and me. I have a new kitten. My wife and I have a new kitten who is very frisky and was a homeless kitten. I don't know. And because he's a homeless kitten, he doesn't behave in the tamed way kittens are supposed to behave. He's sort of, well, freaked out by a lot of things, but we're bringing him along. My wife is much more patient than me. She's bringing him along. I said to her, why do you have to get a homeless kitten? he'll never come out from under the bed. But not only has he come out from under the bed, he's wild in the house. So the day before yesterday, I wake up in the morning. It's light, of course, in the morning now. Oh, no, that was... Oh, yeah, Friday. I don't come to Zazen, so I wake up late. It's like 7 a.m. It's already light. And I feel something on my... I see something and feel something leap up and get my... What's the bottom part of your leg called? I can't remember. Your calf. Thank you. you know, it happens very fast. It happens very fast. And the cat bites me and scratches me, keeps biting me and scratching me, and I move my leg, move my calf, right? Hard, fast. And I said, you're making me mad. That's how I wake up in my nice Zazen Friday morning. You're making me mad. He's making me mad. Look at how we use our language. Our language all focuses on this false identity. You're making... This cat doesn't think it's making me mad. The cat is just being a wild homeless cat in a bedroom, right? Doesn't know anything. But me, my interpretation, you're making me mad. Linda, you got this homeless cat in here. We had a beautiful little cat before. We won't get into that. But you know, on and on and on. The fictional self, on and on. But let's look at it from the aggregate's point of view, from the five aggregates, the five stars in the Big Dipper, if there are five. I don't know. Let's see, one, two, yeah, there are six, I think, aren't there? Yeah, or seven. Anyway, there are only five in this Dipper. So the first one is form. That's my calf, form. The second one is sensation. There's a sensation of pain in my leg. That's the second one. The third one is perception. I have a fleeting perception of a ball of fur sort of flying through the air. And, you know, the fourth one is the impulse. The impulse is to toss it off. And the fifth one is thought, which then goes on about it. Linda, why did you have to get this cat? And why couldn't we just go get a normal cat? Aren't our lives hard enough with our grandchildren without having this cat in addition? So I blame my wife for that. You know, got to blame someone. She's next to me, right? She's the most convenient person, right? The fictional self. The fictional self. But we squander our attention on the fictional self. We squander it. And Buddhist practice is about bringing the skandhas, that's the word for aggregates, into view. Bringing our perceptions into view. Bringing our sensations into view. And not just reacting and thinking and planning and worrying and reviewing and rehearsing. Because then we miss out on each star in the constellation. We don't see them anymore. We don't see how bright each perception is, just in and of itself. That the perception of that cat on me, that was only like a half a second, and then I went into a big trip about it, a huge trip about it. But that's wonderful. And as our minds begin to slow down in Zen, we notice how we do this. We notice how we do this. And we despair of it, but we begin to also have moments where we're really in touch with our perceptions and our sensations. And we're not just covering over them. The middle one of the skandhas of the aggregates is called samskara. Sam, together, skara, make. So it makes something out of our sensations and our perceptions. That's impulse. We make something out of them. And the minute we make something out of them, we no longer value them. We're dissing them. So it's okay to notice that we're making something out of it. That's fine. But then we can come back and be with it. That flashing split second, just as I focus my eye on that ball of fur, before I turn it into an object, before I clamped on it mentally and separate it out, that we have a possibility always to come back to it. And in Zen practice, we begin to develop that propensity, that ability. But of course, we have to do all the other. We have to see all the thinking, all the rehearsing. We get sick and tired of it. All the reviewing, we get sick and tired of it. But we bring ourselves back. We bring ourselves back. So back to the story. The monk asked Kyosei, his teacher, I want to peck from the inside. Would you tap from the outside? Would you please tap from the outside? It says please. In this translation. The translations are all different. Would you please tap from the outside? So he's saying, teacher, help me. Help me in this practice. Help me. Help me. Help me let go of this confined space that I live in. That dominates me, dominates my life. Help me, help me. And the teacher says, so that's key in Zen. In Zen, the relationship between the teacher and the student are key, more than in other times of Buddhism, I think. I don't know about all of it. Having one-to-ones with the teacher in retreats, people come to see me one-to-one. I do one-to-ones on Sundays, I have one-to-ones in the mornings, on the weekdays, but those are an important part of our tradition. Important part of our tradition. So the student comes to him and says, I want to pat from the inside, would you please tap from the outside? The teacher, Kyosei, said, are you committed to being alive, becoming alive or not? Meaning, are you committed to doing this practice? Or are you just sort of entertaining yourself? Because this takes commitment to sit and watch that mind rehearse and review and regret. This takes commitment. After a while, you don't want to do it anymore. You don't want to do it. So he's saying, are you committed? Are you committed to becoming alive? Alive. And the monk replies, if I couldn't become alive, I would become a laughingstock. Not a good answer. Not a good answer. Fails the Zen test. Kyosei said, you too are a fellow in the weeds. In the weeds. Because the monk, he's a monk, right? I mean, monks in China in those days, they would give their lives up, you know. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, they gave it all up, supposedly. Supposedly, I don't know if they really did, but according to the books, they did. To practice, to do meditation, their whole lives. So they didn't want to become a laughing stock. They wanted their meditation to bear fruit. They wanted to lighten up, to become enlightened, to see the light that is in the whole stock sky and not just be focused on the Big Dipper or Orion's belt. Just those fabrications. So he was being honest to the teacher. He was saying, geez, if I weren't committed and I didn't have a breakthrough, everybody would laugh at me. But the teacher said, that's not good, because that's based on comparing. That's based on trying to be like someone else, better than someone else, or as good as someone else. This, what we call the way-seeking mind, isn't about that. It's not about that, you guys. It's seeking for something deeper than our comparing, deeper than our trying to figure out or be better or worse or more enlightened or less enlightened. It's deeper than that. It's a deep, cheap desire to know intimately each star in the sky. And if you know, if you want, know one star in the sky, you will know them all. If you're really intimate with one, you will know them all. You don't need the Big Dipper or the Little Dipper or Ryan's Belt, but you can enjoy them. You can label them and enjoy them. And that's cool. That's cool. So without our way-seeking mind, we spend our life in the weeds. We spend our life in the weeds. And even with the way-seeking mind, sometimes it feels like we're just overcome by the weeds. But then we can just be with them. We can just be with them. Just be with them. They too can become great compost for our practice. Because there's a pure and pristine energy always here, ready to burst out, because this eggshell is very thin. Very thin. And our true nature is to be happy. To be happy. And all we have to do is have one crack in that shell, and we see light. The whole inner part of the shell is penetrated by the light from the outside. And they're not two. They're still two, but they're not two. So that's the first metaphor for this morning. The second metaphor is the metaphor of veils, which is a Buddhist metaphor and also a Rumi metaphor. So I'm going to start. I'm going to quote Rumi. This is love, to fly toward a secret sky, to cause 100 veils to fall each moment. First, to let go of life. In the end, to take a step without feet. To regard this world as invisible. And to disregard what appears to be the self. And to disregard what appears to be the self. This is Sufi, not Zen. What's this guy talking about? Sounds Zen to me, the whole thing. And Rumi would say, well, the Zen stuff sounds Sufi to me. But Sufi and Zen are just labels of constellations in the sky. So of course it won't sound different. Of course. So if, from this point of view, this analogy, this metaphor, the veils are concealers of joy, our natural joy. They prevent intimacy, but they're just gossamer. They're just gossamer. You know, gossamer is very thin and opens very easily, tears very easily. And as our mind begins to slow down in meditation just a little bit, we can see three types of veils. The first are bodily veils. And there's a resistance to bodily stillness. Human beings have a resistance to bodily stillness. So we veil our resistance to stillness through, in sitting, we contract our body. We get stiff. And one of the things that happens, especially in retreat, and in order to get a deep taste of Zen, you have to do retreat. Now, there may be a few people who got a deep taste without doing it. To every rule, there's the exception that proves the rule, right? But you have to do retreat. You have to retreat sometimes. These monks in the Blue Cliff Record, they retreated for, you know, years. But that's why we have retreats here every month. And that's why we do 1 day, 2 day, 5 days, 7 day. We're doing 5 day just in a couple weeks. And you can come for 2 days. But you have to retreat. And if you retreat, if you go on retreat, you'll experience some stress in your body. And one of the things that happens is that you begin to notice stress auras, stress points in your body, which are really trapped emotional memories. They just sort of come out on their own. They just come out of their own. They begin to surface. They start to surface. And we can feel the tension and the contraction moving through when this happens. Because our minds are still, and we're not anesthetizing, we're deeply aware of pain in a way that we usually aren't. Now, this can happen in a half-hour meditation, too, but it's more likely to happen in a long retreat, which makes some people not want to do retreats and other people want to do retreats. But you shouldn't be too eager to do them or not do them, because if you're eager to do them, you'll be very disappointed. If you're eager to not do them, you'll really feel like you're missing something. Suzuki Roshi, my teacher, said the only thing to do about pain is to let it be painful. High IQ, huh? Feel the aches and pains in our bodies. Feel the aches and pains. Watch how they move around until the memories and the old hurts work their way out. Watch with kind attention. Now, this is not a military point of way of doing it. Just with kind attention. Not trying to get someone. We're not trying to compare yourself to someone else. Just with kind, open attention. And the second kind of bodily veil is the veil of movement. We want to be on the move as human beings. We want to stay busy. We really don't like being that aware of our bodies. Americans these days, everybody's doing yoga. So we're finally wanting to be aware of our bodies. Well, interesting. You know what? The most popular type of yoga is that 120-degree yoga. That ain't exactly being aware of your body. That's getting hyped up by this. I mean, it's not that it's bad. It's just that we need that extra something to feel like we're getting somewhere or doing something. And just to be aware of your body as it is without... in yoga, finally they're beginning to do in yoga in the United States a little bit of meditation at the end or at the beginning. But yoga, actually, in the Indian sense, originally was about, it's Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga, which is the meditation yoga. And then all the postures were developed afterwards to help and lead up to doing the Raja Yoga, the eighth yoga, the kingly yoga. So we're getting a little bit into the kingly now. Of course, if you come to Zen Center, you get nothing but, oh, the kingly. Oh, you're in the right place. But now we have to do a little yoga in our retreats because you've got to stretch your bodies. And in Patanjali's yoga, you begin with the body. So we add some of that, too. So anyway, we're a multitasking society, and one of our veils is needing to do stuff. We're like my six-year-old grandson. So I pick my six-year-old grandson up at his school, but they have a French word. That's why. Oh, crèche, I think. But he it's here in Minneapolis, but he calls it by the French word crèche, and he's been moving his body all day. So we get in the car. We've got like a 20-minute ride home. Grandpa, iPhone. Want to play Angry Birds? Ethan, you can just sit still. I'm going to take the nice way home along the river, along Minnehaha Creek. It's really beautiful. It's a nice time of day. Angry Birds, Grandpa! Okay, Ethan, Angry Birds. Then Angry Birds in the back seat, and his Angry Birds. And then he's sitting next to this little girl who's our next-door neighbor, and he's telling her, I got this one. You could never do this. So he's playing the game. He's dissing her. He's talking to her, and he's making so much noise that I can't. I might as well just have stayed on Highway 35. So he's six. But you know, we're doing this at 60, too. We're doing this at 60. We're just more discreet about it. We're just keeping it under wraps a little more. Not always. Sometimes it bursts out, right? But usually we're keeping it under wraps. But we're doing the same thing. It's the veil of busyness, the veil of needing to move, not being able just to be here with this star, regardless how dim it is. It's lighting the whole universe just with its being. So our practice, in our meditation practice, is single tasking with bare awareness. With bare awareness. Until we can return to our true state of calmness. And we will return sometimes. And that'll go away. We will return. We will return. And more and more, that will replace the fictional self as our real anchor in our lives. More and more. So, I've told this story a number of times, but I haven't told it in, I don't know, probably a couple of years. And I read it in something Wanda wrote recently, and I remembered it. Two stories now that I remembered from something Wanda wrote. Wanda is transcribing my talks and putting them into a book form, which is very beautiful. I'm very grateful. But I read one of them from 5 years ago, and I think, oh, that's interesting. That's a good idea for a talk. That's my advanced age. So here I am. So actually, this is a short story. I'm not telling a very long story here. So. When I my first couple of years, my first 3 years of meditation, of doing Zen meditation, my body would shake during retreats. During retreats, my body just shook, and it was embarrassing and frustrating, and I didn't seem to have emotional stuff coming up even. It was just the confined space. The confined space. We're just not used to that. I was only 21 or 22, you know, and I might as well have been six. So it was being in that confined space with no iPhone, no Angry Bird. Well, there was an Angry Bird inside, right? And my body would just twitch so much that I was embarrassed to sit inside. And the head student told me I should go sit outside. But then Suzuki came and said, no, come on, sit in. He didn't want me to sit outside. And I went to him and asked him about the problem. And he said, he scratched his head and he said, I don't know. Ask him. That was Katagiri, the young monk. The young monk. So ask him. He does some exercises. So I went to Katagiri, who was the head teacher here. And I said, Suzuki, you know about my shaking? He said, oh, yes. Embarrassing, right? Embarrassing. Oh, yes. I said, well, Suzuki said I should come ask you. He said, me? I said, yeah, he said you do exercises. So then he took his whatever off and he started leaving me through a bunch of calisthenics. Well, I already knew how to do calisthenics, but I did them anyway. It didn't help. So those are the bodily veils. Then we have the heart veils. The veils that conceal our soft heart, our open heart, our heart that's available to everything, to everyone, including our own pain, including our own inadequacy. We don't leave ourselves out with our open heart, with our soft heart. But the veils that cover up that heart, we get in touch with. When we do meditation, we get in touch with them. There are veils of anger, veils of sadness, veils of fear, many different veils. And we see those coming up in our sitting. And they can throw us off. And we peel away one veil, one gossamer veil, one anger veil, and then below that, what is there? Maybe there's a loneliness veil. Maybe there's a deep loneliness. And we peel that away. Maybe there's a grief about the people we missed, the people who aren't there for us, who we're not there for anymore. And then maybe there's another veil under that. How many veils did Rumi say? Hundreds of veils. But don't get discouraged. They're just gossamer. They're just gossamer. Rumi did not get discouraged. And then there are the mind veils. And with all of these veils, they part naturally as we stay with our meditation practice. As we bring ourselves back to our meditation practice, they part on their own. Right in the middle of the difficulty as well, they will part if we don't compare them to anybody else's difficulty. Not, you can compare them if you want, but as soon as you start comparing, then you're getting into rehearsing, reviewing, and regretting. And that's okay. We need to rehearse. I need to rehearse my talks. It's good for me to rehearse my talks. I need to review my past talks. But, you know, let's just do this for 8% of our lives rather than 98.5% of our lives, huh? That's what Zen is, getting some balance back. Getting some balance back. It's our natural balance, but somehow we got acculturated into this unnatural imbalance. I don't know. So mind veils, a third kind of veil. And that's all the mental chattering, right? That's all the reviewing and regretting and rehearsing and all the gossip, the subconscious gossip. So that after a while, we realize in our sitting, and I don't know if I got this from Trungpa or whom I got it from, that we're connoisseurs of our neuroses. We become connoisseurs of our neuroses. That's one thing that's discouraging about sitting, is that you think in sitting you'll get free, and instead you become so aware of your neuroses. And you didn't think you were going to go into therapy. It wasn't your goal of going to therapy. And of course, this is really not about therapy. This is about being with what's coming up and seeing the space there. Seeing the space between each of the stars in Orion's belt. You know how many miles there are between each of those stars in Orion's belt? Thousands and thousands of miles. But we only see Orion's belt. Suzuki said there are limits to the amount of pain the body can endure, but there are no limits to mental pain. That's right. There are no limits. It seems to go on and on, doesn't it? There are no limits. When the mind slows down enough to see the veils, they often seem impenetrable, but they are just gossamer. So, years ago when I was sitting, and probably been sitting for 2 or 3 or 4 years, maybe more like 3 or 4 years, in San Francisco with my teacher, I came out of a retreat. I don't know how many days, at least a couple day retreat. Maybe it was just a couple days. In those days, just a half day retreat seemed like a year to me. I thought, if I can only get through this half day retreat, I'm never coming back. But then I always kept coming back. Fool that I was. Fool that I was. So we're done with a retreat. It's the middle of winter in San Francisco. I'm walking home. It must have been a half day retreat, or ended at noon or something, because it's not dark, but it's very cold and foggy. San Francisco, believe it or not, is very cold in the winter. It's colder than Minneapolis because it's so damp. It's so damp, and you never see the sun. In Minneapolis, you see the sun. It's strange. People don't. You know, Mark Twain, you know what Mark Twain said, right? He said the coldest day he'd spent in his life was the coldest time he'd spent in his life was a summer in San Francisco. Although some people say he said that about Duluth. And there's a lot of controversy about whether he said that about Duluth or San Francisco. Anyway. So coming home and feeling discouraged, having been shaking all morning while everybody else was sitting still. Everyone else was sitting still. We're doing this Japanese style that everyone is, their movement is smooth, they're bowing to each other. And here I'm trying to do the Orioki, which are the nested eating bills, and my bowls and my body shaking. Embarrassing, discouraging. So I think, on my way home, I think, God, am I doing this? Do I want to continue doing this? What? And I'm in a funk. I'm in a funk, right? And I look down on the sidewalk, and I see a little sprout, a little tiny sprout in the middle of winter, coming through the sidewalk, just bursting through. Oh, that helps me so much. Helps me so much. And I go home, and Suzuki that day has been talking about Kyosei. And he's been talking about breaking through the shell. That's what he's been talking about. He's talking about how he can help break through the shell, but how it's up to you to come to me, he says. It's up to you, but I will do my best. So I see the sprout breaking through the cement. And it just helps me a whole bunch. And I go home and I tape on my off button next to my alarm clock. Because I'm good at turning my alarm clock off at times that normal human beings shouldn't be getting up in the morning, right? I tape something that says, and Wanda said it differently than I remember it. Of course, the way Wanda said it is the way I talked about it last time. So, I don't know. What I tape is, commit to becoming alive. Commit to becoming alive. Because that's what my teacher was talking to me about that morning. He was talking to all of us, but to me. And we all thought he was just talking to us. That's okay. That kind of projection is okay. We need projection sometimes. We need to project. But it was just a projection. He's talking to me, right? So then I stayed with it. Retreat after retreat. Until those veils began to part. more and more. I began, even if they wouldn't part, I could see that they were just gossamer. So just gossamer, I could just let them be. Just let them be. So Helen Keller says, I think I want to preface this by saying, there's no security in the Zen practice. What I'm talking to you about, breaking through the shell, letting the gossamer veils drop, fall away, there's no guarantee. And then they'll come back. And they'll come back. Everything comes back. I mean, what do you think? Everything comes back. The final enlightenment is to just live lightly. To live lightly. Anytime we live lightly, we're manifesting that enlightenment. And none of us live lightly all the time. But some of us live lightly. All of us live lightly at least a little bit of the time, right? And as we sit more, as we get into it more, we lighten up. The bread leavens on its own. We make the bread, we put it in the oven. It leavens on its own. It leavens on its own. So we don't get security from this practice because it's just all this swirling sand, swirling piles of sand. Does that make you feel secure? So what's Helen Keller say? She says, security is just a superstition. It doesn't exist in nature, nor do the children of humans as a whole experience it. Avoiding difficulty in the long run is no safer than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. A daring adventure. That's what we're embarking on when we recommit ourselves to meditating so we can open up to our big mind, to this big universe, which includes thinking but is not contained by thinking. Includes perception, but is not contained by perception. So it's a daring adventure. It's a daring adventure which seems tedious sometimes, seems boring sometimes, seems discouraging sometimes, makes us sleepy sometimes. Right? All those things. So up until recently, I went backpacking every summer. In the Wind Rivers, daring adventure, daring, high in the Wind Rivers, Wind River Mountains. Great, Indian reservation, nobody there, beautiful mountain peaks, but how much of the time does it seem tedious? Do I get bored? Does it seem like I can't do this anymore? I'd rather be home. How much of the time? This is life, isn't it? Anytime we take something on with a commitment, this will happen to us. If this doesn't happen to you, you're not really committing to anything. If you commit yourself, even to a partner, well, that's a big deal. It's hard work. The same person day after day? My goodness. Same issues? The same shit? Excuse me. Day after day? Not reflecting in my relationship. Because I live outside the constellation. Outside, inside, all around. Right. So we bring ourselves back again and again to our immediate sensations, our immediate perceptions. Just like in backpacking, when having really trouble, my friend said, well, just breathe and step. Forget about everything else. Just breathe and step. You can take one more step, can't you? I said, yeah. Well, then forget about everything else. Just take one more step. I knew it was some kind of trick. But it worked. These tricks work, you guys. They work. This is life. See how the shell encapsulates, how it becomes a fortress. See how the veils conceal something huge. And then suddenly, at moments, the mind falls silent. Suddenly, the shell cracks. The veils are parted. Suddenly, And if you don't make something out of it, it becomes normative. If you make something out of it, which most of us do, then you're back to the beginning again, right? You're back to the beginning again because you've let Samskar, the together maker, take over the whole show with his partner Vijnana consciousness. They take over the whole thing. And the fictional self becomes your whole life. Your whole life. So, why not close with Rumi again? This is love. This is love. To fly toward a secret sky, that's the way-seeking mind, to fly toward a secret sky, a sky that we can't know in our conscious, through our conscious mind. It's secret. And yet it's always here, but it's secret. To cause 100 veils to fall in each moment, first to let go of life, to let go of this small, whirring little ball of whatever it is. In the end, to take a step without feet, to regard this world as invisible, and to disregard what appears to be the self. To disregard it. To disregard it. So that's what I want to say for this morning. Questions? Comments? Questions, comments.
Sure. How do you take a step without feet?
How do you take a step without feet? How do you think you take a step without feet?
Internally.
Pardon?
Internally.
Internally? Internally you take a step without feet. Well, when we take a step without feet, we're not focusing on the foot. When I just have the perception of the cat on me, just the pure perception, there's no cat. It's just this perception. There's a cat on my leg, but there's no cat on my leg. I'm just there with it. I'm just there with it. I'm noticing the color. I'm feeling the fur on my leg, but I'm not saying color, and I'm not saying fur. There's just a life. There's no leg. There's no cat. But, of course, in conventional terms, there's a leg and there's a cat. Just like there's a Big Dipper and a Little Dipper. But this is unconventional teaching, you guys. I can give you conventional teaching, too. I was trained as a psychologist. Conventional teaching is very important. Setting boundaries, learning about ego, superego, id. All that stuff, very important. You could be in therapy, too. That's cool. But I'm talking about unconventional. That's here. That's what I talk about. That's why I like doing this so much. Is that helpful or just confusing?
Both.
Okay, there you go. There you go. That's it. That's life. Both. You get the Zen teacher answer there. Other folks. Thank you. Thank you. And the way-seeking mind, you guys, it's here. Give you some vitality. You've got that vitality. You just sort of gotten, something's happened to you, and just come back and do it. I'll tap and you peck, but you don't have to do much pecking. Just a little gentle. Just feel the contours of that shell from the inside. I'll feel them from outside. It'll crack. All kinds of cracks. Just gossamer. Okay. You're on, Nancy.